Professor Justin O'Rean is a behavioural ecologist at the University of Cape Town, and he argues that we're in the midst of what he calls wildlife wars, a conflict where there are no winners. He's in Australia for a series of talks, and he's deplored our attitude and practices, such as shark baiting and croc culling. He's been calling for a much more sensible approach. Professor O'Rean, welcome to Bush Telegraph.
Thank you.
Can we start with a definition of wildlife wars?
Yeah, it's not an official biological term. The field it's part of is human wildlife conflict, and essentially it's the conflict between humans and wildlife over resources. So be that land or be that food, and what we're seeing is throughout much of southern Africa, these conflicts are escalating. They range from lions eating humans through to white sharks eating humans. So apex predators on land and apex predators in the ocean. And, you know, a lot of the research we've been doing as well is once you remove those top predators from systems, how things get out of kilter. So baboons in Cape Town, nothing eats them anymore. And as a result, they've become something of a pest. And these are great challenges for biologists because we have to not only find out what the drivers of the conflict are, but try and come up with solutions.
So you tend to refer to the conflict between humans and animals that are native to that natural environment?
Yes, I know in Australia you have extraordinary problems with introduced species, and it definitely pertains to that too. So we have, I think the greatest similarity is probably the wild pig. We have similar levels of conflict. So it's not only native, it can be introduced species too.
So tell me more about the situation with baboons in and around Cape Town. The nature of the conflict that was taking place, how problematic was it?
It was extraordinary, actually. Going back sort of 10 years ago, levels of conflict were absolutely out of control. Property prices were being adversely affected. Quality of life was seriously compromised by the presence of baboons, and not only for the people, but for the baboons themselves. So baboons were being poisoned, they were being shot, dogs were being set on them. And on the flip side of the coin is that humans would come home to a house which was absolutely trashed, and the house had been closed. South Africa's got real issues with human crime as it is, so most houses are fairly secure. But baboons were working out incredible ways, removing tiling from roofs, popping sliding doors out, removing the beading from windows to gain access to the house. It was break-ins during the time, and very often the baboons learned that the best time, and the great parallel here with human crime, the best time to break in is when the people are there, because then things are open, fridges, cupboards, and what have you. So that's the time to get in, because then you can scare the humans, chase them into a room, get them to lock themselves up, and then you can sit down to a leisurely meal. Open the fridge, get out the sugar, you name it. And it was chronic. I mean, we had, I think the single worst case I had was a heavily pregnant woman with her two-year-old child who'd been pinned in her room for hours while a big male, a lone big male, helped himself to everything in her house. And every time she tried to come out of the room, he would race at her with his mouth open, showing off his seriously large teeth. She actually thought that her kid was at large in the house, so she kept trying to leave the room to find her kid. Meanwhile, the kid was hiding under the bed, absolutely traumatized. So they left, you know, sort of upped and off out the country. And that's the level of the conflict.
What a terrifying experience. What was their natural predator?
Lions and leopards loom large as the predators of baboons, and of course the lions went, Cape Town was replete with both before Europeans came in and decimated the wildlife. And it's actually very interesting, because currently Europeans are very cross with Africans for the losses that we are experiencing. So lion populations are declining rapidly. In my opinion, it's much more of an issue than the rhino, which gets a lot more press. The rhino is of concern because of the rate. It's very much like the climate change story. It's the sudden rapid increase in the rate of removal of rhino. But lions are in much more trouble. They've lost 80% of their habitat. And, you know, Europeans say to Africans, oi, stop that. It's your iconic beast. It's very important. But it's, you know, it's very much part and parcel of poor people uplifting themselves by extracting resources, which typically is the lion's prey, or trying to grow beef, which is their income, and of course the lions eat that. So conflict is just amazingly high in Africa right now.
So in the Cape Town situation, a reintroduction to an apex predator like a lion is not really an option. So what was the approach? What did you do?
Yeah, so the first thing was to understand, you know, what are the drivers? What do the baboons need food-wise? How much space do they need that we have still left in Cape Town? And Cape Town's interesting. Table Mountain, which is a, you know, sort of World Heritage Site and an icon for Cape Town, the only reason why it exists as a national park is because we couldn't build on it and we couldn't farm it. So this big lump of rock. So topography is the greatest conservation agent in the Western Cape and Cape Town. So now we have this lump sitting in the middle of a huge city of 3 million people. And that's where the baboon lives. And they've been pushed into this sort of marginal area. And that means in order for them to get enough food, they've got to push down towards the urban edge. And it's a very hard edge between the buildings and then where the national park starts. It literally goes from house to nature reserve. So the baboons are coming down, and the first program was to just chase them away. And the baboons very quickly realized that, okay, you can push us out, but we're not that scared of you. And they overcame their initial fear of humans chasing them and would skirt around them. Humans are no match for the 4x4 baboon, who can go absolutely anywhere. So they would get into houses, into farming areas. The great vineyards of Cape Town are rich pickings for baboons. There's nothing that they can't get into. In fact, I think the worst type of conflict that we've experienced was when one baboon in particular, I think he made it onto Sydney's the Sydney Herald front page. His name was Fred, and he learned to get into cars. So we have another great crime issue in South Africa called hijacking, and here we had Fred the baboon, who would watch people walking back towards their parked vehicles, and as they pressed the unlock on the remote, the sort of tweet-tweet noise, he would run up to the car, knowing that the door was now unlocked, open the car door, and he'd be in. And you wouldn't get him out until he had been through the glove compartment and all other, open the bags, and that's Fred. Fred was doing the most extraordinary raiding in cars, and he became a specialist. He would wait on the roads and hijack cars. So for a long time, and this is a really interesting story about the urban perspective on wildlife conflict. Everyone, well, not everyone, but a lot of people were opposed to any sort of forceful displacement of the baboons. So there were these men trying to chase them away, but they didn't have tools. And every time they tried to use something, so at one stage they were given bullwhips to make a cracking noise, and people objected. The newspapers had a field day, barbarian management and what have you. And this was just to make noise to keep the baboons at bay. And eventually this reached a sort of stalemate where baboons were coming in, being poisoned, being shot. Something had to give. So we brought in international experts and said, look, can you deliberate on what you're seeing here? What do you think should happen? And they said, get rid of them. Just cull them. Get rid of them. This is spilt milk. These baboons have learned bad habits. You'll never turn it back. And, of course, the population of Cape Town, urban population, doesn't want that. They want to keep the baboons. So we're sort of stuck. We need a sustainable solution. So the latest development has been paintball guns. And paintball guns work very well in baboons because they know that you can affect an action at a distance from yourself.
Just like the recreational one, that team-building,
exactly.
Paintball guns.
Exactly, yeah? Exactly. But there's all sorts of negative connotations to that. You know, you've got people walking around a national park with guns shooting wildlife. And, you know, we have enough issues with guns in South Africa as it is. You don't want to be walking in the mountain and, you know, one of the seven wonders of the world, and there's these people with guns. So something else had to happen. And that's when we arrived at the solution. And that's one of the things I've been talking about here in Sydney is, It's not rocket science, it's a fence. And everyone said it would be impossible to deter baboons with a fence. And so we designed some with, we had one suburb which agreed to finance it, and a 2.4 meter high electrified fence is 100% successful at thwarting baboons. And it's a win-win situation. It's going to save money on management. Raiding dropped to zero in that community. They now like the baboons because they can leave there and go for a walk in the mountains, and they're not in their houses anymore. So we have a solution, and it really was quite simple. So now the issue is convincing the politicians that this is the answer.
And no doubt it comes at considerable cost as well.
It's so interestingly, it's 1.8 million Australian dollars to fence off all the suburbs of Cape Town, which is really interesting because the current budget is 1 million per annum to run 60 people with paintball guns. So it's much more effective, and in 2 years it will be, you know, much cheaper than the existing management. So it's cost effective and more effective at achieving its goal.
My guest on Bush Telegraph is Professor Justin O'Rean, who's a behavioural ecologist from Cape Town University, who's in Australia at the moment. Justin, this is all, it's all very interesting, but why is it relevant, the baboon example, why is it relevant to Australia, where, at least on land, the conflict between humans and animals tends to be in rural areas, and if you're talking apex predators, it's farmers and dogs, or it's a conflict with, say, foxes or feral cats in other areas?
Yes, it's true. You have very different problems. And, of course, you've built the world's biggest fence ever. So fencing, so part of my discussion in Sydney is that the long-term solution for lions, it turns out, if we're going to stop lions from eating people, because they're eating a lot of people, and I'll give you a statistic there. In Tanzania, over a 15-year period, 800 people were attacked by lions. This is recently. this is now. And we just don't hear about it. I mean, it's a staggering level of predation. And Craig Packer, who's the undisputed leader in lion research, has come up with a solution. And it's dovetailing with what we've come up in Cape Town. It's fencing. So he's shown very successfully that if you fence a nature reserve, then people stop going in, lions stop going out, the humans don't get eaten, the livestock of the humans don't get eaten, and the lion population reaches carrying capacity of that land. So the best solution for conserving lions in Africa is fencing. The best solution for conserving baboons in Cape Town and in all the farming areas in the Western Cape, sort of the region around, is fencing. And then lastly, when it comes to white sharks, and this is where the story sort of, you know, I realized that there was great parallels. One of the most important things to do is to give recreational users in the ocean the option of a 100% safe swim. And that comes down to an underwater fence. So fencing for lions, fencing for white sharks, fencing for baboons, fencing, period, is to buy us time while we sort ourselves up and come up with, hopefully, much better technological solutions. It doesn't really pertain to the challenges that you have with dingoes. When it comes to the dingo debate, we've got jackals in South Africa, jackals and caracals. We've got two meso predators. So your dingo is what we would have as a meso predator, because sitting above the dingo in South Africa, sitting above the jackal, is, of course, the lion and the leopard. So there is the notion that if you could bring in the lion and the leopard, you would suppress the equivalent of the dingo, the jackal, and with that, the damage to small livestock. It's very interesting for me to see that the differential response in Australia, the crocodile that recently ate someone up in the north, was killed. Mm. I mean, there was no denying that what the human did was foolish. There was a snagged lion and he walked into the river. And I'd been on that river all of a week before. And there are signs everywhere. I mean, everywhere you go in Australia, there are signs. I think Australia is the best signed country I've ever been to. And of course, you've got so many lethal things that there are signs everywhere. Stingers and crocodiles and white sharks. And there was no excuse, really, for what he did. So why kill the crocodile? It made absolutely no sense whatsoever. It's perplexing. And then we were fortunate that we were traveling around, so we got to meet lots of Australians. We got to meet the grey nomads, which are a wonderful cross-section of society, and poll them. What do you think? And countless conversations, no one was in support of removing the crocodile. Everyone realized that the human had made a very simple error. I mean, we're talking about some lion here.
Do you make the same argument, though, with the great white shark example, where we saw the culling off the West Australian coast recently? Do you equally argue that a surfer that goes off the coast near Margaret River is putting themselves at risk and should know better?
Yes, very much so. So the second fatality in Australia during my visit was at Byron Bay. And it was a white shark who appears to have tasted, and I use that word specifically, an open water ocean swimmer, someone who had gone to live in Byron Bay because they particularly liked doing open water swimming. And what I've been amazed at in traveling around Australia is the number of people that go for seriously long swims in the ocean, far out to sea. And that, in my opinion, is putting yourself at risk. I do a lot of work on seals and sharks, and it's the lone seal that gets taken by the sharks. And if you're in a group, you have a much better chance of not being eaten. Not only by dilution, but sharks tend to avoid groups because groups have got lots of eyes and they're not as easy to predate upon. So you are, without a shadow of doubt, putting yourself at risk. What was amazing is talking to the people at Byron Bay, 24 hours after the incident, And there was no call for retribution. There was a complete acceptance that the human had made a choice and that the shark had done nothing other than explore a food item. Now, when you have a mouthful of teeth, an exploration, a tentative bite, can end the life of a human. And that's really what happened. I mean, there was a very small wound and it just happened to be in an artery. And so the person appears to have bled out. And it was wonderful to see the mayor saying that there was absolutely no cause for concern, no need to install drum lines or nets, and a very calm, accepting attitude that is one of the genuine risks of going into the ocean. Mm. Of course, more people die of drowning on Australian beaches than will ever from sharks.
So do you argue then that in wherever a conflict exists between wildlife and humans, no matter how that conflict is expressed, the answer comes down to adjusting human behaviour and fencing rather than culls, baits, poisoning, trapping, whatever it might be?
No, I can't be as hard and fast as that. I've been very intrigued with the baiting story. The poisoning, I've tried to get as much of the research down. It seems that many of the biologists think that dingoes are very important for biodiversity. So where dingoes are, they're suppressing your foxes and your cats. There is a study which suggests that there's not a huge impact of throwing 1080 all over the landscape. Coming from South Africa, that's an activity which is illegal. You can't use poison in the landscape. It's too indiscriminate. And so there are all these great difficulties. It's such a complicated subject, and there's certainly never a silver bullet. I think the great difficulty that we all have is that we've broken so many ecosystems that we have to manage them. So I would say that in Cape Town, if we do these fences but we don't have apex predators, it's inevitable that we're going to have to manage the numbers, which is culling. Getting over how the hurdle is, the people who live in Cape Town won't accept that. But what's the alternative? It's like your Brumbies. I've just learned this morning, talking to some people at Sydney, that there are Brumbies in Australia which are starving to death and who are cannibalizing the guts of dead horses because they're starving to death. Now, what would be better would be to manage those numbers, because there's nothing eating those horses. So when they've flattened their food resource, then, you know, they're going to starve to death. And what's better, a clean shot or starving to death and scavenging on a dead conspecific? I would go for the shooting side of it.
It's perhaps easier from someone overseas, though. I guess it's easier to make that judgment without the fog or the interference of the cultural relevance that many people place on the animal as well.
Absolutely. Though. And this is really where, you know, after I gave a talk, an open public talk last night, and I think the most interesting question that I got after that was this issue of change, of behavioral change in humans and cultural significance of things. So the Western Australian debate with the shark was fascinating for us in South Africa, because it was paradoxical by virtue of the fact that the whole East Coast has been culling sharks with nets and with drum lines since 1937. I think the first nets went in Sydney. So Sydney, New South Wales, pioneered the concept of shark nets explicitly for the purpose that if you kill enough sharks, the probability of an attack drops. Now, that is pretty archaic. We can excuse that in the early 1930s. Interestingly, during the Second World War, the nets came out and no one was eaten. Everyone was still in the water. So there seems when you put these nets in, there's a massive drop-off. And what they did with the drum lines in Western Australia, they put it in. There was massive public opposition. We were so impressed with the Australian public. And the authorities rode a roughshod over it. All the experts disagreed with the government decision. All the experts around the world disagreed with the government decision, and they still went ahead. That's perplexing. I still would like to know what the real reason is. I suspect it's tourism. I suspect it's the dollar of people coming to spend time at the beach. Something as simple as economics. Mm. And these issues are always beyond the biologists, which is why we've got to work with the sociologists and the economists. And I think the sociologists have got a huge role to play.
So if killing an animal, a species, a predator, does not reduce the likelihood of an attack, and you use the shark instance then, Do we apply the same principle, the same theory to the farming example I gave you earlier, where if you kill dogs, you think you protect your livestock, but maybe that's just not the case?
Yeah, so I think, look, your dog here is your apex predator. So when there's sheep involved, there's no denying that they will do a lot of damage to the small livestock without any shadow of doubt, which makes the dingo fence really interesting. I gather that biodiversity on the sheep side of the dingo fence, where the dingoes have been excluded, is appalling. So there's been massive impacts of sheep and absence of dingoes on Australian biodiversity. On the other side, I had naively hoped that where there are cattle, they would be too big for dingoes. And biologists tell me that that's largely the case. The dingoes will occasionally take a calf or a sickly adult. So in South Africa, a jackal, your equivalent, if there is cattle, we regard that as problem solved. It's the small livestock where there is an issue. So it's very perplexing for us to see that 1080 is being used throughout Queensland, which is almost exclusively cattle. And they really do need that, and it seems to be cultural that you always hit the dingo. There's dingo were vermin. In fact, go back in the history books, marsupials. There was a bounty on marsupials. You were obligated to kill marsupials when you moved into the interior of Queensland. You were demanded that you had to get rid of anything, and it was foreign. It was something different. It was something not to be accepted. And there seems to be a hangover that I spoke to many farmers. On our travels, and you know, the farmer and the farmer's son go hunting dingoes. They put foot traps out. The government helps them with the 1080 poisoning. It's warfare, and it's not convincing that it's actually doing anything other than wasting money.
It's a lot to think about. It's definitely a debate. It seems that it's going somewhere. It's changing, no doubt. Professor Justin O'Rean, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on Bush Telegraph today. Been great chatting with you.
It's a pleasure.
Professor O'Rean is a behavioural ecologist at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Been in Australia giving some talks of late. Some strong views there. I wonder what you think of them. The story is up on our website now. Just go to the RN homepage and find us on the program guide. You can comment there if you like, or if you prefer, you can find us on Facebook and share your views on Professor O'Rean's views of conservation.